You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. And today I have the great pleasure of speaking with someone who, in some peculiar ways, I have known for over 40 years, although I suspect it's about 40 years since we've seen each other. So Michael Stearns, and I won't go through the his pedigree, his resume will emerge from our conversation. But he is a musician, a musical composer. How would you explain yourself when somebody sticks a microphone in front of your face?
Well, actually, I don't.
Somehow I figured that.
Yeah, I've worn so many hats, and they just feel like, you know, where I don't know where they're coming from or expressions of what they are. I just jump in and do things, and it always seems to work out.
Well, good. Well, let me. I mean, you are surrounded by all sorts of things that look like electronic. Some keyboards, some amplifiers, some preamps, some microphones, so I'm assuming you're in your studio?
Yeah, this is where I am set up to do, you know, whatever I need to do.
Whatever it is you do.
Whatever I do, and it's kind of a play space. My wife calls it the pod. And it's filled with synthesizers and speakers and video cameras and just all kinds of stuff. And I kind of work at everything, or a lot of it is hooked together. So I just push buttons if I want to do one thing or I want to do another thing.
Yeah.
Which is great about the technology today. But a lot of the time it's like a giant experimental space and I'm the mad scientist. And so I just take one wire and hook it into another and we see what happens.
Is it confusing as hell? I mean, like, do you sometimes get things happening that you kind of scratch your head and say, well, I wonder why that's happening?
Yeah. Somebody who I worked with, I don't know if you remember Kevin Brahaney.
I remember Kevin really well.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he once said you have to make your worst accidents your best artwork. And so I've kind of followed that all along. It's like when what goes on is, you know, what you just described, I try and see the beauty in it and how I can use that as a part of, you know, as like a fabric to weave into this texture that I'm creating here, this, you know, whatever it is. I don't know.
So, you know, I'm really not trying to pin you down, but do you think of yourself as an artist? Or
I think
somebody who's like, you know, playing in the pod.
Yeah, I think of myself as, I mean, if I had to use a word, I would say an artist who expresses himself through sound and music, as opposed to a musician or a composer or something like that, which I'm usually, you know, asked to be or hired to be or whatever. But an artist would be a good description.
Tell me more about that piece. What do you mean what you're asked to be different from what you just said? Different from you creating. Somebody comes knocking on your door to say, hey, Michael.
Well, let's see. This latest project I'm working on, I've been working on it for about a year, is a score, musical score, for a project that it's a fractal artist who lives in Amsterdam. His name is Julius Horsluis, and he makes these amazing environmental moving fractals that completely surround you in fractal landscapes. And I'd done a project for him last year in New York City, and I didn't really know anything about him or moving fractal landscapes. I knew about fractals, and you go on YouTube and you go through a fractal Mandelbulb or whatever they call it, and it's really neat, and it kind of usually has some kind of techno music or something to it, and you see all these different landscapes. And the most amazing thing about it probably is how it continues to evolve as opposed to ending in some sort of static stream,
right?
Or image. And what always was interesting to me about fractals is that we, other than the word fractals, we don't have a language to describe what a fractal is.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, language is the way that we create and recreate the world, or the images of the world that we live in. It's a symbolic overlay of, you know, that we're taught ever since we learned how to speak,
mm-hmm.
or what we see. And so, you know, when you go into the realm of fractals, there's really no language that describes what you're seeing. And I found that wonderful. And Julius asked me to, he asked me to use some of my music in a production that he did, an installation at a gallery in New York City last summer. And I didn't know what it was about. So my wife and I got on a plane, we flew to New York City. And it was a gallery that was a huge gallery. It was the Artek House Gallery in the Chelsea Market in Chelsea, New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And you walk into the gallery and you're immediately immersed in this moving 3D landscape. And it's very disorienting. Most people just...
3D landscape that is projected on screens.
In this case, it's projected on the entire inside of the gallery.
Uh-huh.
So that every wall, the ceiling, the floor, everything is one moving image.
Uh-huh.
It throws your whole inner sense of balance out, so that most people just sit down so they don't fall down.
Fall over, yeah.
And then you just kind of immerse yourself in this, with my music and these images. And I'd never been exposed to anything like that before in my life. So when he asked me to participate in that, I didn't really have any idea at all exactly what he was asking for until I actually arrived and experienced it. And then after that, he asked me to score his latest project, which I'm still working on, which is in Experimenta, which is the largest dome, planetarium dome in Europe. And in this case, it's a moving 3D, you have to put on goggles, fractal show in a giant planetarium dome. So you start out sitting down, so you don't have this sense of imbalance. And the sound system is 30 channel surround sound, so the sound is basically coming from every direction all around you.
It's as immersive as the fractals.
Yeah. Yeah, so you've got this combination of this immersive visual environment, immersive sonic environment. And again, I'd never worked in an environment like that before. When I was asked to do it, it was, well, how do I do that? You know? And I'd had some experience doing small immersive films for like IMAX.
Right.
But this was way beyond IMAX. I mean, it truly is defined by the word immersive. So anyway, I jumped into that and I've been working on that for about a year now, and I probably have another 3 months or so to work on that.
And does it require you sort of schlepping all sorts of equipment from where you are to where you're going to end up? I mean, how's that work?
Well, I have, you know, my studio, as I mentioned a moment ago, is filled with these musical instruments, and I have a large immersive sound system in here, formatted right now for what is called is the Dolby Atmos format, which is what some of the more cutting edge movie theaters have,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of the sound systems in home theater systems have Dolby Atmos as well. So I was able to take the sound system in here and modify it, not physically in space, but through the software that I had never used before. It was another totally new thing for me. It's a software that is used evidently for immersive sound systems in Europe a lot, and also used for gaming. But at any rate, this I was able to reconfigure electronically the sound system here to mimic the sound system at this giant dome in Europe. So last week when I was there, for instance, I took my soundtrack, and I've been working with a sound company in Heidelberg, very close to where the dome is. And we were able to take what I had done, and then through the miracle of digital technology, we were able to make it work in the dome really beautifully. It really stood up quite well.
So the environments he creates are, the fractal environments he creates are continuously moving.
Yes.
I mean, I guess until somebody pulls the plug, right? But they're continuously moving, and they are, at least as I understood it, they're not programmed. They're not predicted.
Well, he works with specific algorithms, and he has spent so many years working in this medium that it's not like he can predict every element that happens, but he can work with different algorithms and mix them together, much as I, and this is one of the things that really attracted me to it, much as I sit at a mixing console and take these different kind of colors from my musical palette and weave those together to make what we call a piece of music. Mm-hmm. He's kind of doing the same thing with the fractals, but we have much more of a, we have much more of a language that's based in music, whether it's based in Western music or Balinese music or East Indian music or, music from some tribe in the Amazon. There's a language that describes, is it minor key, major key? When you get into microtonal music, it gets much more complex than that. But you're actually, and in a way, much simpler than that. And fractals are mathematics expressed visually. So the wonderful thing, as I mentioned earlier, for me, the wonderful thing about fractals and this environment that we're creating in this giant dome is that when you walk in and sit down, you're going to spend an hour in an environment that you have no language for. So you can't describe it other than experience it.
Right.
So that your brain, there's some part of your brain that will have to organize differently or will have to release and open up. And by the time you come out an hour later, you're going to go, what was that?
Does he discover that there is an urge to do that? Like that people have this urge to like try to in some way capture, hold on to, make static what is absolutely not static. Was there that response?
I think he came to it through his own, not through an intellectual process, but through through the love of it. Maybe he was tricked by the muse. I don't really know. I got tricked by the muse into making music when I was about 14 and I went to the community swimming pool and there was a guy there playing guitar and all of the girls went right
there. It is.
You know, and I thought, oh, I have to get in on that.
Yeah.
That's how I got tricked by the muse, and this is what it's led to, you know. And yet the muse of fractals is so the muse of fractals is speaking to something I'd say more abstract, but actually more primary in terms of it's the language of mathematics that actually describes the natural world that we live in. In other words, if you look at the edge of a leaf, that's basically a fractal landscape. If you look at a mountain range, that's basically a fractal landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's I would say fractals are actually an expression of the natural world.
Right.
In the same way that microtonal music can be based more in the mathematics of the natural world, mm-hmm. than the world of equally tempered music, which is what we all grew up with, which is a 12-tone scale, which we all know is a little bit out of tune.
Right.
And it was invented by these guys in wigs 300 and some years ago.
Yeah.
So it actually didn't come from the natural world. It came from the minds of these men, mm-hmm. and got expressed in the clavier keyboard, which became the piano keyboard, which became the keyboard you see on synthesizers, because somebody realized you could sell more synthesizers if you had a piano keyboard on it. And it goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
Let me just talk about one more thing, because these thoughts came up while we've been talking. I kind of see myself having been led into this realm. I mean, I've done a lot of planetarium shows, and I love that immersive environment, but I've done these films for Ron Fricke. The first one was Kronos, which was an Omnimax film,
yeah.
Then Baraka, and then Samsara. And for me, one of the wonderful things about that, those kinds of films, which we call nonverbal films, which include Koyaanisqatsi, Poikatsi, Nikoikatsi, and a number of other nonverbal films, is that when the audience goes in and sits down, there's no human language. You watch 90 minutes or more of images without any human language. So you kind of, as Ron describes it, you make up your own stories, and every person in the theater has a slightly different story that they're making up, rather than having actors on the screen who are, you know, following lines or whatever. To lead you down one of these kind of archetypal paths. Is it a love story? Is it a disaster story? You know, what kind? Yeah. One of these patterns, which we, through our inner dialogue and the dialogue that's expressed in the outer world through films and such, we continually recreate who we are and our culture through these stories that we keep telling ourselves. So, but when you go in and you see a nonverbal film, you have to make up the story inside yourself that goes with the images. And when you go in and see this fractal show, you can't really make up any stories, because you've never really seen anything like that.
That's really interesting.
So I just wanted to go back and bring that up.
Well, it's also a really an interesting arc, right? I mean, to be, you just said you were led into this, and at least where you are now, who knows what's next, but where you are now is working on something that where there's no language to make it up. What comes after that? Either silence or everything. Who knows? Yeah. But that's so interesting. So would you mind circling back to the, you know, just not because I want a resume, but so here was a guy playing a guitar. You decided, ooh, that's interesting for all sorts of, you know, peripheral reasons, And then what? Did you end up going to music school? Did you study? Were you self-taught from the beginning? Were you one of those people who just this came, quote, easily, whatever that means? Or what's that story?
Well, I've definitely self-taught, although I've had a lot of influences along the way. You know, maybe I sat down with an amazing guitar player and learn some licks off of that person, but anyway, that came a little later. Initially, I was playing in this band with the same guy, same fellow who had introduced me to the guitar and girls, so he and I formed a band, and I kind of learned some things from him, got an electric guitar, and then that band kind of grew, and I learned more and then wherever this leads, Okay. So at some point it became the late 60s, and I had been in a private school for boys, and I got, and then I went to college, and that was right at the time of like acid rock and that kind of music.
Sure.
Well, Jefferson Airplane, Flaming Groovies, the beginning of the Grateful Dead.
Right.
And so I was in a band that was called the Universal Joint, and we played all around the San Joaquin Valley while I was going to school. And I would go into San Francisco on weekends when I wasn't performing and go see these amazing groups, you know, Winterland and, you know, places like that. And,
yeah.
And so that was a big influence on me. And I, at some point after the first year, I just had had enough of college. It was like, I just wanted to do music. I didn't want to go to college, but it was in the height of the Vietnam War. It was 1969.
Mm.
And so I dropped out of college. But before I dropped out of college, once I told them I was dropping out, I had like a month to just stay in the dorm before I had to go home. And so the band, we had all of our equipment in this big closet, one of those big closets in a dormitory or someplace. And,
closet.
Yeah, I got all the instruments together and I just kind of locked myself in the closet for 4 or 5 days. And I created this piece of music that was really unlike anything I'd ever heard before. And when I played it for friends, they'd say, "Oh man, that's great. I got to get stoned and listen to that," you know? So the only way that people could relate to it at that point was through drugs, really. But to me, it was like, you know, I dropped out of college. I did this piece of music. My parents came and argued with my teachers, "Why does he want to drop out of college?" And they all said, "God, we think it's a great thing. He actually knows what he wants to do."
Right.
So I got drafted and I was able to sidestep the Army. I went and sat in an Air Force recruiter's office for 4 or 5 days. So he gave me a slot. I got into the Air Force. And when I did, I had these realizations of, you know, that piece of music that I created as I had dropped out of college and kind of let go of all of the expectations that my parents had had for me to become whatever, a doctor, a lawyer, and my grandparents' expectations and all that stuff that gets loaded on a kid. It was like just saying no to all of them. And in that release of energy, I sat down and created this piece of music, which I've always felt was seminal in the direction that I've gone.
Mm-hmm.
When I got out of the Air Force, I played in a band, and it was quite an experience. It was it was in Tucson, Arizona, but it was a Las Vegas show review type of band, and with all the movements, and we had this singer, and he could do all the James Brown imitations. I mean, it was a big thing. We all had matching outfits with sequins and all of this stuff, and two of the players in the band were heroin addicts. And I mean, it was just, it was crazy. So sometime while that was going on, a woman who became my girlfriend and eventually my wife at that time had heard about this woman who had lived in Haiti, who was coming to give a workshop at the, I think it was the Southern Arizona Mental Health Center. And she had been to Haiti and she spoke fluent Haitian. And at the time I spoke fluent Haitian. So it was like, okay, I've got to go do this. And I had been thinking about completely dropping out of music. And actually, I had begun dropping out of music. I'd started selling off all of my musical instruments. And there was a Sufi master who lived in Tucson. And I decided I was going to apprentice myself to the Sufi master. It's like, I was kind of in this spiritual conundrum where I knew I had to do something majorly different in my life. And it had to involve something that we call abstract as being spiritual. But I didn't know exactly what it was going to be, and that seemed to be what was local. So there was a music store, and I just started taking my amplifiers. At that point, I had all of this equipment.
Mostly guitar-based stuff?
Mostly all guitar-based, yeah. And well, some I had a few tape recorders because I was still trying to capture this thing that was bubbling up in me that I didn't have any audience for, but it was my passion. I had to do that. And so Emily and Gary came. Gary was performing music for Emily's workshop, or I would say creating a musical context, wasn't really performing so much.
Right.
And I took the workshop and I really connected with her and Gary. And about halfway through the workshop, I was sitting meditating. And Gary was playing, he had a Moog synthesizer and he had a tape recorder and he had these prepared tapes that he had made that he would play and then play the Moog synthesizer on top of those tapes. And that was what he was creating this meditative environment with. And at some point he played this tape background that I recognized as I was meditating. It's like, oh, I've heard that before. What is that? Then I realized what it was. And so after the meditation, I walked up to him and I said, Gary, he said, how did you figure out how to take this one part of one track off of a 1958 album by Ken Nordine called Word Jazz and play it backwards at half speed? And he looked up at me and he said, you're the only other person in the world that would know what I did. You've got to move to Los Angeles. 2 weeks later, I moved to Los Angeles.
That's actually amazing, because to recognize something backwards and it's so specific, it's so, I don't even know. Yeah, there's, that's not a, I can't even imagine. I don't have a language for how that happens, because that in and of itself is so unusual.
I mean, I don't think there is a language I think that happens to everybody and it happens a lot, but we just kind of dismiss it. Mm. And some people call it, I mean, there's an aspect of it that we call synchronicity. Mm. Although in this case, it was recognizing something familiar kind of in the call of your destiny path, I would say, because yeah. My whole destiny path shifted in that moment.
Yeah.
It would never be the same again.
Yeah, I get it. It's, and it doesn't even, you know, thinking about it as communicating, as minds linking up, so Gary knew what it was, and in an environment, or maybe you knew what it was, but you knew it before. So it's like, this doesn't, yeah, that's something. That's really great. That's great. So off to California, and then would you say your world, you were completely immersed in Things Continuum, right, in that work?
Yeah, I was. Yeah. The urge was to play music and start to unfold what I was doing as a musical context for Emily's classes, just as Gary had been doing. And at the same time, I was taking Emily's work, mm-hmm. And getting very involved in it. And the woman that I mentioned earlier who had become my girlfriend and was going to become my wife, who had moved with me to Los Angeles, who had also taken the workshop with Emily and Gary and really connected with the work that Emily was teaching. Mm-hmm. She and I had moved there. And when I first started doing that, there was a percussionist there by the name of Fred Stofflet, who would create these amazing environments with different percussive instruments that, you know, everyone would participate in with Emily's movement meditations. And at some point, I asked Fred if I could play with him. I guess I must have, because that's what we ended up doing. And I would play with him and create. I had brought with me some surround amplifiers and a surround mixing console. And so we set up speakers around the room so that I could take what Fred was playing and manipulate it so that it would become not just this percussionist at one end of the room, but everyone would be immersed and surrounded in this environment, musical sonic environment. So I played with Fred for a while. Gary was playing for the classes. Don Preston, who was the keyboardist for the Mothers of Invention, was playing for the classes. And that over time evolved into, you know, my playing for the classes on my own. And
I remember many of those classes, actually. So
there you go. Yeah. And I had this urge to take some of my music and release it as a solo artist. And I had written this piece of music that ended up becoming called Ancient Leaves, which was my first release as a cassette and a LP initially. And that led to creating music. That led to creating a way of supporting Susan and I. Susan had been supporting us up to that point. She had a job as an accountant. And so she was working with Emily a lot and becoming one of the principal teachers at Continuum. And I had been playing for Emily's classes. And then I was working with Craig, and there was some income from that. And then I released this album, Ancient Leaves, and Susan and I began taking my music to what at the time they called New Age Fairs, which were popping up all around the U.S. And we had a booth. Do you remember George Landry?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Well, George, you know, he built these flats for us, and we made this booth that we could put in the back of our Volkswagen bus. It was very hippie-ish in a way. And we would go to these different New Age fairs, and we'd set up a booth, and we'd sell my music. And after a while, we got to making a bit of money from that. And so sometime along there, once I was, you know, pretty entrenched in my music, Craig called me up and said, hey, I'm exploring, you know, writing music for picture. Composing, and you know, would you be interested in working with me on that? So Craig had just built a beautiful studio in his home up in Sherman Oaks with all the very latest equipment, and so I ended up going and engineering and being, you know, kind of helping him with the composition and everything. And anyway, I did that for a couple of years, ended up and learned all about scoring for picture. And probably my biggest influence during that period was being able to work for 2 years on 4 separate productions with Maurice Jarre.
Oh, wow.
Famous French composer who wrote for Dr. Zhivago and Lawrence of Arabia. And so Maurice did 4 projects in Craig's studio, and I engineered all 4 and really felt like he was kind of this oblique mentor for me. I mean, not just as a composer, but how he went about composing. And just, he really became a father figure for me. He would take us out several times a week at night, at like 11 o'clock at night. We'd go to Trader Vic's or something, and we'd all sit around the table and eat, and he would tell us stories. And it was absolutely wonderful, just a wonderful environment. Mm-hmm. And when I finished that 4th project with Maurice, which would have been about the end of 1981, and I took this material that I had been working on and wove it into this piece of music that I called Planetary Unfolding. And it went out in the world and kind of became a fairly big thing in what we used to call the New Age music environment.
Yeah.
And Maurice heard it, and he thought it was quite amazing. And after this Continuum ended, Maurice's stint in Craig's studio ended all at the same time, or very close to each other. And that fall, I was approached to score this film that Ron Fricke had done called Kronos. And I went on to score Kronos, which we finished in 1984. And that kind of put me on the map in a whole different, you know, perspective in terms of the way other people thought of me and the industry, whatever that industry was, thought of me. And I kind of had some creds after that.
Did you get people knocking on your door who were making, quote, conventional films? So were you suddenly thrown into a more mainstream, oh, he's a film composer?
Not really. Not immediately. I ended up, that was 85 when that ended. And then I immediately went into of producing and sometimes scoring the soundtracks to a number of IMAX films. I ended up being 22 IMAX films by the time I was finished.
Wow.
I kind of got adopted by these different film companies, McGilvery Freeman Films, Graphic Films, who were all producing IMAX films at the time, mm-hmm. as the go-to person to produce their soundtrack.
Yeah.
And I had a IMAX sound system set up in my studio so that I was composing not only and producing not only the musical or physical soundtrack to a IMAX film, but also orchestrating it spatially simultaneously, mm-hmm. because it's a great 6-channel sound space in an IMAX theater, or it used to be. Now it's even more than that.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of went from Kronos into that realm, scoring other projects, documentaries and things at the same time. And I also started to get a name for myself working on what we call special venue films and special venue attractions, perhaps. The first one I was asked to do was, it was called Earthquake for Universal Studio Tours. So you would get in one of their Universal little mini buses and you drive into this like garage, and suddenly the whole thing would start shaking and water would pour down, and then this giant truck would crash through the ceiling and catch on fire. So I produced the soundtrack for that. How I got that job, I don't even remember. But once I got that job, I was called into the office of the president of Universal Studio Tours, and he had this big lunch going on with catering trolleys coming in and these vice presidents. And one of the images I remember is this guy getting a cigarette out of his like gold cigarette holder and putting it up to his lips. And this vice president literally running in with a lighter and lighting a cigarette for him. I had never seen anything like this before in my life. And he said, "So, Mr. Stearns, what have you done for us?" And I said, "Well, the only thing I've done is this earthquake ride for you." And he said, "What?" He said, "What? Well, that's all you've done?
Why are we feeding you lunch?"
Yeah, exactly. And I said, "Yeah, that's all I've done." And he said, "Well, what can you tell me about that?" And I said, "Well, actually, it seemed like, everything had been engineered in the wrong way from the very beginning. And I started to describe to him all these different engineering issues, which I had to fix in terms of the production of the soundtrack so that it would work within the environment, which it hadn't been working at all when I got there. And I guess he was kind of impressed by all of that. And he said, "Well, I'm looking for somebody to be the head of sound here for Universal Studio Tours." And I immediately cut in and said, "I didn't come here looking for a job." And he said, "What? What?"
"Give me another cigarette."
So, they offered me lunch, which I declined because it was all roast beef. It was all like red meat galore. And there wasn't a vegetable on one of these trays that they brought in. And I left that scene and then turned down the job because there's no way I wanted to get tied into that world.
They offered you the job.
They offered me the job, yeah. And so I, you know, I was young, but I was smart enough to say, no, thank you.
Went ahead for the door.
Yeah. So then I got offered to the job of producing the soundtrack to another Universal Studios thing, Back to the Future, The Ride. And so that's how I started on that. And then all the way through, went through that project. And
it's such an interesting and weird niche.
Yeah. Huh? And then I got asked to produce the soundtrack to Star Trek, The Experience, which they built this whole building in the Hilton parking lot in Las Vegas, and created this whole replica of the inside of the Enterprise with this fake transporter so that you would be taken into the Enterprise. And then they had people in Klingon outfits and all of this stuff. And then you would be asked to get in one of their shuttlecraft, and you had to go shoot Klingons, so, you know, or Romulans or whoever it was at the time. And so I had to, they had a, you know, mini dome in some place in there, and they had a shuttlecraft, and everybody got in the shuttlecraft. So I programmed and produced the whole soundtrack to that. And that was like 20 channel surround or something like that. So I did a number of those shows, kind of back to back, what we call special venue shows. Yeah. And I learned a lot about surround sound, while I was doing that, and special venue attractions, like how do you integrate what you're doing with visuals and also motion. Because all of these things had they gave you the kinesthetic sense that you were actually a part of the film, flying through the film.
Yeah.
So where were we? You know, the body is named Michael Stearns is talking to the body that's a David, and we're you know, but what led you here? What led me to this moment? It's like, are we, you know, was there a big bang, or was there a start of what we call time? Mm-hmm. And then everything that's unfolded through all the generations and all the refugees and everything, and our great, 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 great grandparents down to our parents, down to this moment where we're looking at each other. It's like, that's the for me, that's the language. It's like, whatever that is, that unfolding is, that's the only language that I understand. And it's not that I understand it, that I acknowledge. I've been asked to score a documentary, beautiful documentary about the first Nepalese woman to climb Mount Everest. And then she ended up climbing it 9 times subsequently. And now she works in a Whole Foods in Connecticut.
I was about to say, you're going to tell me something banal, right? Like, oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, and her life story is absolutely amazing. And they've captured the whole thing in this documentary, and they've asked me to write the music for it. So I'm going from, did we talk about this already? I'm going from the completely abstract mathematical language, complete surround, 30 channel surround, down to the life story of a Nepalese woman who climbed Mount Everest.
Wow.
So I don't know where it's going next. Who knows? And that's part of what keeps me interested. We're participating, as Gary would say.
Yes, exactly. My friend Gary. Who knew? Who knew when you sat in the closet in the dorm?
Yeah.
That this was happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, or who knew when you were out on the dance floor continuum, moving and exploring what it means to be human in a way that no other context could offer you, that you'd be sitting behind a microphone talking to the guy who was making music at that moment.
That's exactly, that's so many, and with all of the twists and turns in the middle.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it was life on a sailboat, and then a school, and then starting a school, and what? Kids and teachers and Wyoming. What? So are there, because I want to respect, well, I've already eaten up too much of your time, but are there, so I, you know, I recognize your willingness to participate, we'll use that word, with what comes next. And are there projects you have sort of or projects you wish were like sitting there on the shelf for you to do, that you're like waiting for the opportunity to do, to explore this? Are there some of those lingering for you or emerging for you?
I feel like I'm a fount of creative projects, and I try and write them down. Mm-hmm. And I realize a fellow that I was working with about 2 years ago said, you know, part of what's the word? It's not shame. It's a part of our feeling of loss as we move through life, is that on some level, and it's not necessarily a conscious level, we realize that we'll never be able to do all of the things that we want to do. And there's a sense of grieving. Grief is the word. There's a sense of grieving that's going on in the background because of that. And I really connected with what he was saying. It doesn't stop me from writing all these ideas I have down. I have 2 albums of music, which I haven't released, just because for me, at this point in my life, it's more fun to sit and make music than is to jump through the hoops of having to release the music and all of the hoo-ha that goes along with that. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm not interested in that. I haven't been interested in it for a long time. Mm-hmm. But sitting and creating, that's wonderful for me. It feeds me so deeply. Mm-hmm. So it's like, there's one project. There's one project. It's been with me for many, many years, which I'm not holding on to it at all. I hope that in some level it happens with some people. Some people, come across it in the way that I came across it. I must have been 30 years ago, 35 years ago. I was sitting with a friend of mine up in the Bay Area, the South Bay. Can't remember the name of the little town she lived in. But we went to see this James Bond movie called Moonraker. And I came out of the movie, and I was like one of those moments where you're just struck with an idea. And I sat down on the curb and I thought, God, what if you could project images on the moon and use the moon as a screen so that half of the hemisphere of the planet could see a single object, and since it's circular, it would be like a mandala. And then, because of the way that at the time it wasn't the internet, it was just the possibility of satellite, like I was doing a lot of music that was broadcast on the Hearts of Space show, and that was being uploaded to a satellite that was going down to about 300 stations across the United States. And then they could pick it up and play the music. And now we have the internet. But what if you could then have a soundtrack that was being disseminated simultaneously as you had these images? And that's, and then I studied, and then I didn't study. I took this laser scientist, physicist out who had been working on one of Ronald Reagan's projects and told her what I wanted to do. And she said, Ronald Reagan has been creating the foundation for what you want to do, with these lasers. And she went in describing all of this technology and everything. And so I don't even know if it's possible or anything, but that's kind of like this. Oh yeah. Michael Crichton, the author.
Yeah, sure.
Well, he was a kind of a friend, acquaintance of mine for a number of years. And, so I took him out to lunch one day, and I when I lived in LA, and I ran this idea by him. And I said, I don't know if this is something that needs to be done, or it's a script for a Hollywood film. Because that would be kind of right up his alley.
Absolutely.
And he looked at me and he said, "No, you've got to do this."
Well, maybe that's what's next. That sounds spectacular.
I'm not attached to doing it. I would love to see it happen. Yeah. But the scale and the amount of energy and work and all of that it would take to pull something like that off It's like I don't have that in me anymore. And at this point in my life, I thought I would be more in a position of mentoring rather than still creating.
And is that something that, you know, are there tidbits of that in your life?
There are tidbits of it, but I thought it would be on a different level than it is.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I find myself continually being asked to create. So I don't know what that's about. I just keep, I'm just moving on, you know.
Yeah. Well, what a pleasure this has been. I mean, I've known you in some very far away way for years, and yet I don't think I've ever known the story. And I still love the image of being in that closet in the dorm room, and something emerging.
So, yeah.
Well, I am glad that whatever forces that brought me to Emily's class at the same time as you were at Emily's class has led to this moment where this body is talking to that body, and thank you. Thank you for being willing to spend all this time.
Oh, well, thank you for the opportunity to, yeah, you know, to reminisce and to
meet
the beauty, to re-meet the beauty of who you are, and to, you know, just, I don't know, it's like, what else would there be to do?
Yeah. I love thinking back. I can even remember the drawing on the cover of Ancient Leaves. I had a cassette, and I hadn't thought of that in years, and there it is. So thank you. Well, Michael Stearns, a great pleasure, and thanks for spending this time. And I hope whatever is left of your day, which is actually a lot because we're in the same time zone. Where are you, by the way?
I'm in Santa Fe, New Mexico, a bit south of you.
Yes. Well, I hope the rest of your day is lovely and wonderful.
And the same to you, David. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.